This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed people around us that we can call heroes because we don't really realize the lengths that they've gone to protect and preserve our freedom. Each week on this program, we visit with veterans of World War II. Our intent is to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories. And what a story today. A lot of this story you can find in book form. It's a really unique and captivating book, very well written, by a 94-year-old World War II veteran named Jerry Countess, lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. The book is called Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. I have it linked on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. And Jerry's going to tell us some of that story today. First of all, I got to ask you, Jerry, 94 years old, you got a full head of hair, you still drive, you look like you have a lot more energy than I do. What's your secret?
Well, I don't know about having more energy. I have some, but it looks better than it is. I suddenly find myself walking now slower than I used to, and I walk past the store, and I see this big store window, and I look in the window, and there's an old man walking down there, and I finally read, that's me. that's very scary.
Jerry's had a very colorful life. He's been in Las Vegas the last 40 years, very active in the Jewish community here. And if you visit his office, you'll see pictures with him of with former Israeli heads of state, people like Shimon Peres and other faces that you might recognize. But long before that, you were just a young boy growing up in the Big Apple, raised by a single mother. What was your life like growing up there?
You have to remember, we were growing up, coming to life towards the end of the Depression. The worst part of it had been over, but everybody we knew had to work. Nobody was really trained in modern things like today. Most of the people that I knew, I lived in a part of Brooklyn called East New York, most of the people I knew there were men and women who came from Poland and Russia primarily, some from one or two other countries, with no training, and most went to work in the garment district in Midtown Manhattan. My mother lived in Brooklyn and had to take two trains every day to get to where she worked in Manhattan. And there was no such thing at that time as an 8-hour day. It was more like a 10-hour day in most cases. But I was fortunate. She was fortunate. She lived with her mother. Her mother knew 10 words in English. She was a good cook, a great housekeeper. And she took care of our small three-room apartment. My mother went to work. She went out 6:37 in the morning, didn't come back till 6:37 at night. I almost never saw her. I saw her long enough for her to give me the facts of life as she knew them. You know, how to behave and how what to do. That was a different kind of behavior than you hear about today. But it was true for everybody. We learned a somewhat different world than there exists today.
So growing up there, spending a lot of time with your grandmother and your mother and raised, as you say, with that view of the world and that kind of discipline and morals that they're trying to instill in you, I'm sure you had a lot of dreams of what you might do. I can see the energy you have today, and I can only imagine as a teenager, your head was probably full of some grand ideas. What were the things that you had ambitions for?
I don't think I had any ambitions until I graduated with a 79 3/4 average. That was 1/4 of a point less than I wanted to go to a particular high school where all my friends went. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get in because I was 1 point short, so I had to go to a different high school. I went to Boys High, but purely by accident, when I was about 13, 14, I stumbled into the Brooklyn Public Library. Can't tell you how that changed my life. Mm. I went into the library. Of course, it was free. I looked at this huge amphitheater inside. It seemed like huge to me. Nobody was there to tell you what to do. There were people there, but they didn't tell you what to do. So I went to the first bookcase set that I saw, and I looked at it, and a lot of books. And I looked around until I finally found one where there seemed to be books that I might be interested in. I got very interested in it. For a period of 2 years, I read a book every day.
Wow.
I took that book home. I sat down and I started to read it. I went to sleep at night when I finished it. In the morning, I went to school. From school, I went to the public library. And the public library was about a mile from my house. And I walked back. I did not know that I was reading what today we call the latest classics. I read Edgar Rice Burroughs, everybody you can name, the old guys, especially some of the guys whose stories, H.G. Wells and a couple of others like those, created sci-fi.
Uh-huh.
Everybody you can think of, every big writer. And I didn't know that I was reading the classics, but I found this one bookcase, which was 8-10 feet long and 6 feet high, and that's what it had. So every day I went to school, and I picked this book and went home with it.
Opened up a whole new world for you.
It opened a new world. I had no clue, nor did any of my friends have any clue about the world I was reading about. That changed me.
A few things that I'm curious about. First of all, I know that your Jewish heritage is such a big part of your identity. You know, if we look back now, and one of the things that we realize is what was happening in Europe was the extinction of the Jewish people at the hands of Adolf Hitler.
Yes.
Do you remember the first time you became aware of what was going on over there?
I became aware here in the United States before I went overseas, before I joined the Army. I can't say that I was on fire to attack it or not. I figured the Army would take care of that. All of the people I knew, most of them were Jewish, felt that way, but they never really talked much about it. We talked between ourselves on occasion, but never did. I never thought, first of all, I never thought if I went in the Army, I would be in the fighting part of the Army. But I never thought of being somebody who wanted to go out and fight that. But I thought that that was something we needed to do. And I thought that the Army, the gross Army, would some part of it would do that, as they subsequently did.
And you had a hand in that. And we're going to hear about some of that. Another question I like to ask every veteran, because everyone seems to remember something. December 7th, 1941. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, where were you and how'd you find out that news?
I was in Brooklyn somewhere, I don't know. The only thing that all of us knew immediately was that the selection of people to go in the Army would suddenly mean something. And suddenly it made a difference. You knew that if you had a low number, you were going to be out there early. The guys I knew were pretty smart. They became accountants, bookkeepers, lawyers. None of them were in the fighting group of soldiers. Mm-hmm. I was the only guy in that group that did.
Well, and you tried to take matters into your own hands. You wanted to be in the Army Air Corps. You even tried the Navy. And tell me why they wouldn't take you.
They wouldn't take me because I was, unfortunately, partially colorblind. Just before we got in the Army, a friend of mine learned that the Coast Guard was interested and they needed people badly. We didn't know how dangerous it was to be in the Coast Guard. Even though all you did is you got on a ship, there were usually eight or nine or ten people who made up a little group, a little squad, and their job was to take care of the two-way radio. So he and I went to the Coast Guard and they said, oh, we need you. Come on and join us. So we came down and we looked out, filled out, and said, okay, fill it out. You have to take a test and you're ready to go. So first they gave us a physical test. They took everything. They said, you're a wonderful guy, but you have to take the test before you go. We were so confident we were going to be taken in. We filled up our travel bag and we went on the subway to downtown Battery Park. We kissed our parents goodbye and we went down there and we passed everything. And then the guy said, well, before you go, you have to take the color test. So they gave us what was called the Ishihara eye test. It's a color test. And they show you a book with 16 pages. Each page has a different picture on the front made up simply of colored dots. And if you weren't colorblind, you'd look at it and see immediately, this dot's 13. I watched the other guys doing it. They didn't seem to have any problem. So I sat down at the table and he opened up the book and I saw a bunch of colored dots. He said, what number do you see? I didn't see any number. So of the 13 or 14 things that he showed, I saw five. When we finished with that, he looked at his captain or chairman or whatever and said, they shook their heads. They said, no. And I said, why? He said, look, if you're on a boat in the Atlantic Ocean, 1,000 miles from shore, and something happens to that radio, if you're going to put a red wire where a blue wire or a green wire is supposed to be, you're going to blow up the ship, you're going to blow up the boat, you're certainly going to blow up the radio. They couldn't take a chance. The Air Corps said the same thing. They said, look, one of the things you will be doing as a pilot is to be strafing the enemy lines. If you can't tell green from brown, you might be strafing our lines instead of the enemy line. We can't take a chance on that. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a good reason.
But you did end up in the Army in the Quartermaster Corps
for a while. And I was very happy with the Quartermaster Corps.
Because you thought, okay, if I'm in the Quartermaster Corps, I'm not going to be on the front lines.
Well, I thought that, and I thought I was going to be doing something useful. They put me in a huge boiler, about 20 feet long and about 6 feet high. And the whole purpose of it was to provide water so that when soldiers came off the battlefield temporarily, they could throw their clothing in there, have it sterilized and washed, and pick up another pair of stuff, new stuff that had been already washed and that was clean.
This is the bath and sterilization department.
Sterilization and bath, that was the name.
Uh-huh.
It made a lot of sense. Also, they had a thing with 8 showers alongside so soldiers could get a hot shower.
But if anyone reads your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, they're going to see that you say it was love that cost you that spot in the Quartermaster Corps. It was love that did a lot of things. And the love was directed at someone in this book that's referred to as RJG.
Joyce Gannis, yes.
Uh-huh. When did you first meet?
We met in 1938, I think.
And you developed some pretty strong feelings for her.
Very quickly, we did. We were close together for a year or two. She went to Brooklyn College at night, as I did. I lived on this side of town. She lived over here. I drove my bicycle across town to her. We walked from there to back to her house, which was another mile or two. And we stayed out together until 12, 1 o'clock at night. And then I had a ride back by bike all the way across Brooklyn to the other side. But I didn't care. I was happy. I was also young.
Yeah.
My thighs were like that. Solid iron. At any rate, we did that. And then when I got in the Army, she got word that she was accepted for the Barnett Memorial Hospital in New Jersey, Paterson, New Jersey. But when I heard that she had gotten into that school and I knew I was going overseas, I knew that if I didn't do something quick about seeing her, we weren't going to see each other, possibly never. So me and two other guys who were in the regular Army went AWOL on a Saturday morning. We got a train, which was a 6-hour ride to New York. But we got a train. We went to New York. These two guys went out and had a great time for the weekend. I saw her. She said, oh, I had to go to the school where she was in Paterson, New Jersey. I went there. I found her. Everybody looked at me in an Army uniform. What the hell are you doing there? But I found her, and I proposed to her, and I said, okay, let's get married. We have a weekend. And she said, no, I don't want to be a widow before I'm a wife. She said, for me, marriage is something serious. I'm not going to do this for a one-night stand.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I wasn't happy, but I understood what she said. I said, okay. And we kissed, and I got back into Manhattan. I got on the train at Penn Station, and I went back down to where it was. The train went down about 3 hours, no problem. And then suddenly the train stopped, was moved over onto a siding. Nobody knew why. We sat for over 2 hours until another train coming up from the south had to go past us, and they had to have the open road to go. Mm-hmm. So they went past us, and then we got back on. The train went back on the road. But I arrived back at Fort Lee, which is where I was at, 2 hours after Reveille in the morning.
Uh-oh.
That is precisely what. So I thought, well, you know, they won't let me take a weekend off, which is what one of the forms of punishment that they gave you. Well, you know, if you're sitting in an Army barracks and you couldn't get away for the weekend, it was no fun. So me and the other two guys went in. The two Army guys got 30 days. They couldn't leave the barracks. I got 30 days in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what jail was, but it was just a small building. It wasn't a regular big jail, and you couldn't get out of the building. However, they gave you a job. You couldn't just sit in the jail. My job was to go out with the cleanup detail every morning. The truck went around the and picked up the full barrels of waste. Except after 2 weeks, suddenly, I got pulled out of jail, put back in my barracks, and 3 days later, they told me, goodbye, you're going in the Army overseas. When we got on the boat, we were given guns. In basic training, we had been given 1908 Springfields.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to shoot 12 shots. That was the training with a gun.
That was the extent of your training, and now you're heading overseas with an infantry division.
When I got overseas, I didn't get a Springfield. We got the brand new M1s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us anything about the guns. Just, here's your gun.
And his overseas experience would be quite interesting and quite hairy. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of today's guest, Jerry Countess. And we'll be back with more of his story right after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real.
a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.